This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. A joint study by Khazanah Research Institute and University of Malaya found that wealth in Malaysia is increasingly concentrated among those who are already affluent. This despite official government figures show that household income inequality has been declining. How did this study come to this conclusion? Well, helping us understand what household income is and what a Gini coefficient and all these economic terms in the studio with me, Dr. Lee Hock An, who is a senior lecturer from the Department of Development Studies, University of Malaya. Welcome, Dr. Lee. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Hock An, I just wanted to find out what triggered or where, how does this need for a study come to be?
Good question.
Because we have government figures. I mean, you didn't have to reinvent the wheel.
We do have the government figures. However, yes, I had noticed that the government figures were plotting a pattern of declining inequality over the past decade. So I started to observe this about 3-4 years ago. And it kind of escaped people's notice. Nobody was talking about it, about declining household income inequality. In fact, if you know, judging by just people's casual conversations, people's anecdotal accounts and perceptions, everybody is talking about rising inequality, or at least persistently high inequality. So there was this puzzle, this paradox that in people's perceptions, very widespread, inequality is high or rising, but according to the government's statistics, inequality has been declining.
Right. And this is what the Pew Research Center in 2013 had to say about perceptions of Malaysians and inequality of income is concerned. Malaysians are one of the least troubled by inequality. They are among the least concerned about it as a problem, the least likely to think it's growing, and one of the least likely to say the economic system is unfair. So there you go. Hence the reason why we didn't really pay attention to it.
That's quite interesting, yeah, because it doesn't seem to be the sample that I have, observed, mm-hmm. Where it's overwhelmingly people feel that inequality is rising. But this very when it says the least, it's among a sample of a few countries in the world. And just to put it that in context, some of the countries that considered this problem the worst were, one of them was Greece, that stands out. And I think with their economic woes, I think there's very much of these perceptions are fueled by your current conditions and how you, and so if on quite a widespread scale, people are struggling to make ends meet, they tend to feel that inequality is high and a problem. But that does not necessarily mean that if you actually measure inequality objectively, it's much higher.
When you say inequality, what are you referring to?
Okay, I think without getting too technical, but again, for the government figures that had plotted this trend of declining inequality, it is very specific to household gross income or gross household income.
And what is
which
household
includes,
gross
that's
income?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it would include income from a variety of sources, wages, self-employment income. So wages for employees, self-employment income, it could be rental income, it could be dividends, it can be transfers from private or family sources as well as, through public sources, the government assistance. And it would also include all earners in one household. So it can be one, it can be two, or it can be zero if a household has, nobody's earning income but it's just surviving on transfers from family members or the government. So that could be one source of this paradox, that there could be things that are happening within the household and household income that may be resulting in this declining household income inequality.
When I was reading, and I became very confused. I'm like, why didn't they just look at individual income and calculate it? Why look at the household income?
Well, we should look at both household, because that is the unit that is meaningful for a lot of people, for our living, and households often spend money as a unit. We should look at both. You're exactly right. And the source of data, the household income survey, can be used for analyzing individual or personal income, personal earnings. We could be looking at before tax, after tax. You know, we can be looking at household earnings and then break it that down further. So there's so much more that we could do to get a much more, you know, a detailed, a finely grained picture about inequality.
This household income survey is used all over the world as an economic indicator. What does it really tell you?
Household income. Well, there is no, you know, there's no data bank somewhere where income data is being deposited. So to know how households are doing, what they're earning, you have to go and actually survey.
But on an economic level, what does it tell you? What does it indicate?
It would indicate what households are receiving, and that is important because it would give a picture in terms of how much, what share of the economic growth is going to households in terms of income growth. Mm-hmm. It is the definitive way to look at inequality, and that is important to ascertain, to estimate. I mean, most of the time, these are also estimates, right? We shouldn't be, too definite about these because, you know, that it's a huge and quite mysterious and unknown thing. So the best we can do is to do some survey and to get as good a picture as we can about the inequalities, about whether, you know, about how opportunity and outcome are being distributed, whether there are segments that are being marginalized. And so it is, you know, it's very much socially important. To me, and politically important, and you know, to me, all three are inextricable: mm-hmm. social, political, and economic.
So, how did you go about doing the research differently from how government would have probably done it? Your findings actually back the public perception that mm-hmm. income inequality is growing.
Yeah. Well. So. Okay. We don't have access to the household income survey. Mm-hmm. It is very, very expensive, very difficult, and often requesting it, we don't really get the data set that we request. So a preview into the take-home message is, please let us have the household income survey for doing this kind of analysis at the individual level. But we were, so we had to, you know, we had to source elsewhere. And we it was kind of an adventure in that we considered this and tried that. In the end, we settled on EPF savings accounts as an indicator of inequality, both in terms of cumulative savings as well as earnings, because EPF derives from basic
certain
wage.
Percentage, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a big chunk of the population, currently 6.5 million active accounts. So that's one. We thought car sales would be interesting because car sales they also derive from income. And so we collected some car sales data, and we have something to report about that. We looked at housing sales and the inequality. So we're looking year by year, the years that we were able to get the data, how in these different snapshots, what's the level of, what's the picture of inequality? So I think, yeah, those are some of the main ones. Also some unit trust accounts.
So in terms of the sample, yours is a very different sample.
It is very different. I mean, there are some major limitations. Yeah. One is that we don't really have one, you know, data set that is encompassing the whole country, unlike the household income survey.
So are we...
And it's different snapshots, and it's at the individual level, which is a good thing, but we cannot account for multiple, either multiple sources of income. For instance, you know, if someone is earning a wage as well as some other income on self-employed, because in the EPF it's only accounting for the wage.
So are we comparing apples and apples?
Not exactly. No, we are doing our best to report on inequality on a national level. So in that sense, you know, there's that commonality with the government statistics, which are at the national level. But you know, we have a few snapshots, but there is a consistency in most of them that is pointing to rising inequality.
What is the consistency?
There is rising inequality. So yeah, the government's computer, and for most, we also compute the Gini coefficient as with the household income survey.
Gini coefficient. All this economic jargon. Explain to us the Gini coefficient.
The Gini coefficient is a number between 0 and 1, and a higher Gini coefficient basically means a higher level of inequality. So the household income, official statistics shows the Gini coefficient having declined from 0.46 in 2004 to 0.43 in 2012.
So income disparity is falling.
According to that, income inequality is declining. It's also declining in the urban within urban areas. So that, and that's important because much of our data, I think, is quite urban-centric, you know, housing, EPF, car sales. So our story still holds in that our findings are somewhat at odds.
Okay, so what do you do with this data?
What do we do with the data?
Mm-hmm. So you've come out now and said that, you know, okay, government figures are actually wrong, I still don't want to agree with that because you're not comparing apples and apples. Your sample and the way you've done the survey is very different.
Well, right. we're not saying that the government figures are wrong. We are saying that there's something strange going on, that you know, that household income inequality is declining. But in these other, especially individual-based measures of inequality, it's rising. So we should actually be looking at the household income survey at the individual level. And let's see what we get when we do that. One possibility why household income could be declining, but individual earnings can be rising, is if there's increasingly young adults, working adults, living at home, in which case their earnings, their salaries, would count towards the household that they're with, their parents' income and this young working adult's income. But in terms of, you know, who has control over that money, it's not, maybe shouldn't be considered as a whole household. So if you have young workers and their wages are, the growth is very slow, it's being stagnant, and they're living with families, it's counted towards those household income. This is just one conjecture that we make.
Okay. And the minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Dato' Sri Abdul Wahid Omar, he says in September that the average household income surpassed 5,900 ringgit a month, improving on the 5,000 a month figure in 2012. Now, it was perceived as being out of touch with reality, and it sort of drew widespread public, criticism. But what does this number actually mean? And how does that translate to what you have found out in the survey?
Yeah, the number is, I believe that these numbers are computed professionally and objectively from the household income survey. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a very, you know, thorough and authoritative source with about 50,000 households that were sampled. So we shouldn't casually dismiss it. And the fact that there has been growth, now that rate of growth was really high. So that does raise some questions. And therefore, we want to look at what's happening within the households. So, you know, I wouldn't question it just on the face value, but to ask that this needs to be probed further. Because it could be household, again, there could be increase in the number of earners within a household if, you know, young working adults are increasingly living with their parents.
But the household income survey is not enough to sort of draw conclusions on national inequality, is it?
The household income survey is a source that can be, you know, it's a goldmine of data that can be taken in many directions. We can look at it at the household level, at the individual level. We can look at we can estimate wealth as well from that, and look at income.
Is it enough to draw?
It's the best that we have, and it is the international, you know, best practice, because there really is no other way of knowing what the inequality picture is like until you actually go out there throughout the whole country and you randomly ask households, you know, what is your income? I think we could also ask whether or not it's being conducted in a way or whether it can be conducted in a more effective way. But I wouldn't, you know, have any basis to say that it's not being done in a proper way. But that's I think, another discussion, I think, that can take place.
What prompted this research between Khazanah Research Institute and University of Malaya?
Well, Dr. Muhammad Abdul Khalid, co-researcher, you know, he's a friend, and it's and we embarked on this after we had observed this puzzle of government data pointing to declining inequality, and whereas perceptions, and as well as the period in which we see this declining inequality, we don't find anything that has changed in terms of the structure of the economy or policies that is consistent with that. Unlike a few countries around the world that have registered declining inequality, especially in Latin America, in the last 10, 15 years. Now, there's a neater, you know, story that tallies, where you have a leftward shift in a lot of countries in electing governments that took the country in a different direction and increased the redistributive program. And they were very much elected on mass support from lower income. So they had, you know, so and then you see declining inequality measure in the same way in these household income surveys. So you had that in Latin America. Malaysia registered declining inequality but didn't undergo that process. So that also, you know, is piques our interest. Okay. Again, it's not to question the government statistics. That's not our motivation. But it's to answer these questions that arise with this, you know, paradox of everybody's talking about rising high inequality. The statistics are showing declining inequality, and the government itself hasn't, you know, drawn attention to this until quite recently, until this trend of declining inequality.
Okay, we'll come back and find out more about the research that was carried out on economic inequality in Malaysia. Dr. Lee Hock An, a senior lecturer from the Department of Development Studies, University of Malaya, in the studio with me. This research was carried out with Khazanah Research Institute and UM. When we come back, I want to find out whether inequality is necessarily a bad thing. What do you think? Send us a text message, 016-201-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio, or, you know, send in your questions for Dr. Lee to answer them. That's up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, and I'm Mira Sivasuthi. In the studio with me, Dr. Lee Hock An, who's a senior lecturer, Department of Development Studies, University of Malaya, discussing economic inequality in Malaysia. There was a study carried out very recently by Khazanah Research Institute and UM, and they found that the wealth in Malaysia is increasingly concentrated among those who are already affluent. And this sort of differs from government figures that show household inequality has been declining. And of course, public perception that inequality is growing. So when it comes to drawing conclusions comprehensively, how do you make some sense of all of this data that you've got in front of you, Dr. Lee? I mean, you now know, okay, this is these are your findings. So what do we do? Yeah. So what do we do next with this?
Yeah. Well, some of what we find is consistent with perceptions. I think people's perceptions are very much driven by what is visible, what is more conspicuous. And so their wages, you know, they're confronted with on a regular basis, and you might feel that your wages are not increasing much or getting you very far in terms of what you can spend, and then you see others are doing very fine. So you get this, so that feels, that's one. You might think inequality is rising. Or one, and car ownership is another, mm-hmm. right? So struggling with paying the car loan, and you're seeing luxury cars on the road. You see that increasingly. So that's another. And then housing, that's also very conspicuous. And we do find that in these three, that there is evidence of rising inequality. So it is, validating maybe a bit, making the point too strongly, but it's consistent with perceptions of rising inequality. And as I said, the household income survey, another source is the labor force survey, which does collect wage data. These are two that I would appeal to be accessible. They're already funded by taxpayer money. So and in many countries they are freely available. You can just download them on the internet for free. So we should be more open, and this should be available for us to do further research. But we cannot replicate anything of that scale and quality because it's funded millions with a whole Department of Statistics.
Some would argue inequality is inevitable. So what? We are a capitalist economy, right? Mm-hmm. The world is a capitalist economy. Yeah. I've always mm-hmm. said that we need to strike a balance between a socialist and a capitalist economy. Mm-hmm. But that no one's listening to me. So what did you expect? The rich will continue to get richer, and, the disparity will continue to grow.
There have been different episodes in history, some where inequality is rising, some where inequality is declining. If inequality is rising, but and at a time of very high growth, then in a way, some of those effects are moderated because everybody is doing a little bit better, and people don't really get so up in arms about rising inequality. But if economic conditions are so-so, then I think people will feel the pinch a little bit more. I think at one level, it is a question of social justice and a sense of fairness. I mean, there's no clear-cut ways that we could draw the line and say that this is an acceptable level, this is an unacceptable level. In many ways, globally, the level that we are at right now, 0.43 Gini, is considered high. And if we looked at other countries that have a Gini coefficient of 0.2, it shows that it's possible. It shows that you can organize an economy differently, still be dynamic, growing. I mean, of course, one of the Nordic is sort of one paragon. Not necessarily have to go in that direction, but it's showing that it is possible that you can have still dynamic, innovative economies with relatively less levels of inequality, and that tends to correspond with higher, better general levels of health and education, more accessibility and quality of all of these, because you're functioning in a different way.
Where do you see Malaysia? Where are we?
Where are
in
we?
In Malaysia, in terms mm-hmm. of are we growing? Are we growing at a faster pace?
In every way, we're kind of in the growing. Middle. It's not super fast, but it's still a level that is respectable. And some other countries would be would still envy to have 5% growth if you're growing at 1%. But inequality as well. I was going back to how it's perceived in the international context. It has become more widely recognized as a problem. Even the IMF. Which in decades past would have dismissed it as something as an afterthought, not really. It's inevitable in the market system. Recognizing now that there are problems if inequality persists, you have buildup of debt if it's because there's stagnant wages. So people would start to accumulate things out of debt. But to me, I think it's more important because growth to me, economic growth is the means towards an end, a broader objectives of human development, and we see the historical record that countries with higher human development tend to have lower levels of inequality.
And if government figures show that this inequality is indeed declining, do we know why it's declining?
why is household income inequality? It's not really been explained because it's not really been analyzed. I think, you know, I think it has escaped notice because it was not really been this long-term objective, and therefore it wasn't really tracked, it wasn't really monitored. We don't really have policies that are targeting it at a general level. I mean, we have been looking at inter-ethnic inequality quite a bit, inter-regional inequality, but not the overall systemic inequality in Malaysia as a whole.
So if your findings show that inequality is indeed rising, then what do we do about it?
Well, I think we would need to, the analysis needs to be broken down by that, you know, the different forms, as we've been talking about a bit. Earnings, income, wealth,
and what there are different interventions. That's very interesting. Earnings, income, wealth, yeah. In my mind, is all the same thing.
earnings and income are more similar in that it's money coming in. Yes, yeah. But it doesn't stay in. It's more of a flow, right? Yeah. You get it, and you cannot buy it. You don't buy and sell. You don't trade in your salary. Whereas a wealth, an asset, something that you can buy and sell, something that you can accumulate, it can be inherited. So that's very different, like housing, you know, like financial assets. Okay, and that inequality tends to perpetuate more because it can be inherited. You know, you grow up in a rich family, private schooling, and so on, and so your life goes on a different trajectory. Earnings inequality, wages, self-employment. I mean, it's basically a wage you're paying yourself, right? Would have, you know, different considerations. Whether or not, and we are talking about that, you know, the dependence on low wage migrant labor. We do find in the study that young workers' wage growth is very slow. So these are the things that, you know, we need to look into why that is. We have this data that we can generate an overall picture, but we don't really know the characteristics of, like, looking at our EPF data. We just know what the level of inequality is, but we do not know what's the level of education of, you know, this data source that we have. What's their background? You know, what are their occupations? For that, we need to. Again, we need to tap into the household income survey.
So what will you do with this data that you have collected now?
We will, we present our findings, including here.
Because how is this going to translate to policy changes, or how is it going to make an impact? But I can see weaknesses in this survey that you've actually done because... Mm-hmm. of the lack of data of household income surveys and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's very not conclusive in my mind, not conclusive enough to convince me that the data is strong enough. That's number one. Number two, and if it's not strong enough, then what sort of difference is it going to make to me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. How are you going to influence whether there's going to be a change in policy? Mm-hmm. For income,
yeah. Well, my first hope would be that the household income survey would be made available without restrictions for us to analyze, to check whether what we have found so far, which I agree, you know, the data has major limitations. We feel that that's the best that we could do, mm-hmm. aside from the household income survey or the labor force survey. But it is very significant that there is evidence of rising inequality, while household income inequality in the official statistics has been declining. It's the main implication is that we have to probe that further.
We are striving to be, or rather we're on track, apparently, to become that high-income nation by 2020. And in light of your study, is that actually possible? Are you saying that it may not be the case, or we will reach that high income nation status, but the income disparity would probably be larger even there.
Yeah, well, the household income, the high income status is quite a crude, you know, measure of gross national income per capita. So total national income divided by population. It has no direct bearing on inequality. I think we will get there eventually. I'm not sure, you know, if we just continue growing at this kind of above average pace, then eventually, you know, you will get there. But I don't see that as that kind of very, you know, transformative achievement. Because high income to me, you know, entails a lot more than just that GNI per capita, you know, and part of the goals of Vision 2020 are much more than income as well, in terms of democracy, in terms of social development, and I think included among that would be issue of distribution. So, you know, we I think these are goals that can marry together. You can pursue, you know, more equal distribution. Not identically equal or everybody earning the same and forcing that, but greater fairness and as well as, you know, higher income.
Are there particular areas you feel we should be looking at to reduce this income inequality?
Education is... Well, it's a standard answer for the solution to all our woes, but particularly here, you know, it's under research. We really need a much firmer grip on what's happening there. It's possible actually that education could be something that is driving reducing inequality, because as tertiary education expands, and this was the case in Latin America, that the premium on holding a degree, for instance, will dissipate. If there are very few people with a degree, then they can command a premium over those who do not. But if increasingly more hold a degree, then it's not so special anymore. But, you know, that hasn't been studied. So it's one thing that we should be looking into. And as well as for fresh graduates, for young workers, how is having that degree, you know, impacting on their earnings in terms of their capacity to command a wage that should be corresponding, you know, with bargaining power as well as skills and productivity.
Any other areas you want to point out?
Well, the wealth inequality is it should be a major concern, because, you know, it tends to reproduce over time. And we want to be we need to be mindful of you know, the experiences, I think, in countries where then you start to get very stratified or divided, mm-hmm, between the top and the rest, and you can have people orbiting in this elite world, high income, attending private schools and getting health services in private clinics, while, you know, others get left behind. But and that kind of distance can also perpetuate over time, in that you have those who are operating and affording these private services then not bothering with the rest and wanting to, you know, and not wanting to be to be taxed for supporting the rest who depend on the public services. I think that's really quite a real danger. We want to avoid getting into that kind of a situation.
Just very quickly, do you think GST, the implementation of GST, will help fix this problem in the long run? Not immediately, but in the long run.
GST, I really don't see that much of a link. If anything, it's quite indirect. I mean, GST is affecting prices, and so not so much about income. But in terms of living standards, you know, I think it's expected that lower income, you know, will be more impacted. Yeah.
Okay. Your message on economic inequality in Malaysia?
Message on, I think it is, you know, there's so much more to probe, and the household income survey is the primary and authoritative source. So please let us have access to it, that we can know more and have a richer discussion.
Thank you very much for joining me. Dr. Lee Hock An, Senior Lecturer from the Department of Development Studies, University of Malaya, on economic inequality in Malaysia on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.